Hi, y'all. I'm Melissa Harris Perry, and this is The Takeaway, a reminder. It's been more than 2 years since Aurora, Colorado police put Elijah McClain in a chokehold and injected him with a sedative during an arrest. McClain lost consciousness, was hospitalized, and was later removed from life support. But now,
grand jury has indicted 3 officers and 2 paramedics in the death of Elijah McClain. He's the 23-year-old black man who was put in a chokehold.
It's been nearly 18 months since Greg and Travis McMichael pursued, shot, and killed Ahmaud Arbery as he was taking a jog in a neighborhood in South Georgia. But now,
the former district attorney of Brunswick, Georgia, facing an indictment in connection to her actions surrounding the Ahmaud Arbery investigation.
And although the public only recently learned about it, it's been more than 2 years since Louisiana State Police troopers brutalized and killed Ronald Green during a routine traffic stop. But now,
in video obtained, released, and edited by the Associated Press, the brutal and violent arrest and subsequent death of Ronald Green is captured on body camera.
If justice delayed is indeed justice denied, then we must ask, is justice possible in any of these cases? Or the hundreds of others that never make the headlines? If there's one person I know who could help me respond to this question, it's attorney Ben Crump. He's been the attorney for a lot of high-profile cases, including Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and the town of Flint, Michigan, and is attorney to Ahmaud Arbery as well. Mr. Crump, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me, Melissa. It's such an honor to be with you.
Can you explain to our audience just a little bit about the steps along the long road when someone is unjustly killed, maybe particularly in cases of racist violence or state violence? What does it take to get some kind of indictment, some kind of accountability?
Well, Melissa, when you think about the killings of marginalized people of color by police or quasi-authoritative figures who are not people of color, when you have an unarmed black person killed by a white police officer, you often see we have to go through extraordinary lengths to be able to just get simple justice, to get due process. Obviously, we all think back, and it's hard to believe, Melissa, it's almost 10 years coming up on the killing of Trayvon Benjamin Martin, 17 years old, walking home when he was profile pursued and shot in his heart by the neighborhood watch volunteer who had a 9mm gun. And it was there that I first started telling everybody, when you're black and you're killed by a non-black person in America, you have to fight in 2 courts. First, you have to fight in the court of public opinion. And then if you win there, then just maybe, you might get a chance to have your day in the court of law. No guarantee, because we saw with Eric Garner, we all won the court of public opinion, but yet his family, his mother, Ms. Gwen Carr, they still have never got their day in court.
In what places is it necessary for a grand jury? So one of the things that we see so often is that local prosecutors will say, well, we've got to take this to a grand jury for indictment, and then we'll hear that there is, that the grand jury has decided not to indict. But in other places, it seems like the DA, the prosecutor, simply indicts. What are we missing as a public on this?
Well, you know, what I believe it is, Melissa, and I write about it in my book, Open Season, The Legalized Genocide of Colored People. It is this notion, this concept of the intellectual justification of discrimination. The prosecutor who often do not want to charge these police officers when they kill people in our community unjustly, they will come up with ways to try to not administer justice as they're supposed to. And what they often do is say, well, we don't have enough evidence to create probable cause to charge the person. So we're going to turn it over to a grand jury. And if the grand jury doesn't indict them, doesn't come back with a true bill, then we're going to say, well, we left it up to the people of the community, and they made the decision, which is such ridiculousness, because what we all know is that they can prosecute a ham sandwich if they want to. Literally, Melissa, it is so deep that they get the grand jury to return indictments on 99.99999% of the time. But Melissa Harris Perry, when it's a white police officer killing a black person, then that number is reversed. It's almost as if they can never get an indictment. Even when you have video and such, all kind of objective evidence, they say, oh, well, the grand jury didn't come back for an indictment. And what they failed to tell you is the grand jury is made up of lay citizens, and they're the only lawyer in the room. And so it's whatever that prosecutor wants them to do, they're going to do. And that's why it's so heartbreaking as we continue to fight for the family of Breonna Taylor, because you had Daniel Cameron, the African-American attorney general, the Republican attorney general, who went in that grand jury room. And even when members of the community asked questions about, can we even consider charges of murder against these police officers for shooting down this unarmed young black woman in her own apartment, he told them no. That decision had already been made based on the law that they couldn't charge, which is a perfect example of the power that the prosecutor wears in the grand jury box. So we got to call BS when they come and say, oh, well, the grand jury failed to return an indictment. That's because you gave them information to reach that conclusion.
Speaking of exactly that point, the former district attorney in Brunswick, Georgia, Jackie Johnson, is now facing an indictment herself connected to the actions surrounding the Ahmaud Arbery investigation. Can you say a few words on that?
Certainly. My co-counsel, Attorney Lee Merritt, and I, we applaud the efforts of Chris Carr, the Georgia Attorney General, for coming back with this indictment, and the grand jury having all the information to see that this prosecutor gave more respect and gave more consideration to the murderers, the lynch mob who chased Ahmaud Arbery down and lynched him for jogging while black. And what Jackie Johnson did was, even though she saw that video on day one, the same video that we saw, 72 days later, she made a decision that she was going to try to help her friend, former police officer Gregory McMichaels, who with his son Travis McMichaels hunted Ahmaud Arbery down like a dog in the street, and we saw killed him with that shotgun, those two shotgun wounds. And so what we often see is prosecutors put their thumbs on the scale of justice, whether it was, you know, the prosecutors in Michael Brown case in Ferguson. Obviously, we just talked about Breonna Taylor, but then you saw with Ahmaud Arbery. Had that video not come out, she never would have charged the killers. But even worse than that, she obstructed justice by talking to the person who she was going to refer the case to once she came up with this alleged conflict of interest. And so it was almost like a conspiracy that we believe was going on to make sure that the killers of Ahmaud Arbery were never going to be brought to justice. And so this should be a precedent for these prosecutors who, for decades, Melissa Harris Perry, have always tried to make sure justice was denied to black people in America.
Now, I know that you are not officially representing the family of Elijah McClain, but I want to talk about just one aspect of that case out of Aurora, Colorado, because one of the things that police used in their and have been using in their conversation around that is excited delirium. It's also language that we heard in other recent cases, and it sounds like such a official medical psychological term. Can you talk about it a little bit?
It is one of the most asinine concepts that I have ever heard of when you think about it. This excited delirium theory is this concept that says once the police put you in the chokehold or the police put you in a prone position, then if you have, and you die, and if you've ever once used cocaine in your life, they try to say, oh, well, you have a history of cocaine use. It could be 20 years ago or what have you, Melissa. They then try to say, oh, the cause of death is not what you see on that video with the police having his knee in the person's back and them being handcuffed. The cause of death is unrelated to the acts of the police. The cause of death is going to be this concept that the police experts, people who testify for police on a regular basis, have developed, and the courts over time have adopted as actual science, even though there isn't sufficient data or testing to be able to prove that this concept really exists. It's like, if it was for real, I believe, Melissa, we should see people just walking down the street falling out dead based on this concept that, oh, if you use cocaine once, it can cause stress on your heart, and unbeknownst to anybody, it can cause you just to die. I mean, the only time they cite excited delirium as a cause of death is in police in custody deaths. Nowhere else do they cite this. And again, it's just the prosecutor's attempt to justify the unjustifiable actions of excessive force by police officers. And it goes back to Jackie Johnson, who I say very profoundly, she did not pull the trigger to kill Ahmaud Arbery, but she played a starring role in the cover-up. And that's what happens so many times with excited delirium. Even though the prosecutors did not put their knee in the back, didn't do, you know, these terrible physical acts to these unarmed black people who they killed, but the prosecutor will then come and be the start of the cover-up. They will tell the police, we got you. We're going to make sure that you get a get-out-of-jail-free pass card. You have so many dynamics going together, Melissa Harris-Perry, to be able to allow the police to kill us legally. Whether it's excited delirium, whether it's qualified immunity, the United States Supreme Court doctrine that says all the police have to say when they kill us, no matter how unreasonable and how much objective evidence we have, all they have to say is three little words. I felt fear. I felt threatened. And then the Supreme Court say, oh, you can't Monday morning quarterback the police. You weren't there. And if they felt this subjective fear, then everything is justified. Even though, yet again, we have another black man running away, shot in the back. And we're going to say the police didn't use excessive force.
Attorney Ben Crump, thank you so much for always being a companion on that long road to justice. And thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Continue to use your voice for the voiceless and to uplift our culture.
So how do organizers and activists ensure sustained media attention and public pressure demanding victims are not forgotten and assailants are held accountable? Scott Roberts is Senior Director of Criminal Justice Campaigns for Color of Change, the nation's largest online racial justice organization. Scott, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So talk to me a little bit about how we take these stories that sometimes are 18 months, 2 years, sometimes even longer than that, when they first come into our public consciousness. How do we sustain momentum around them?
Yeah, this is a great question. I'm glad we're talking about this today. You know, within organizing within kind of the world of campaign strategy around these cases for justice, we talk a lot about the drumbeat, you know, keeping up a steady flow of communication, of action around these cases, keeping them at the top of mind, making sure that they are, that we're making interventions in our political system around these cases. I think that oftentimes, you know, especially for those of us who are following at the national level, these cases look like, you know, there's a short attention span around them, right? You know, national media, even to an extent, national organizations like my own, you know, show up, talk about these things when they are, when they've captured the national consciousness. But the reality is, on the ground locally, the families, local activists and organizations are involved in really long fights that can be really drug out over, as you said, months, years. And I think, you know, one of the core tenets is sending a clear message to the community that we're not going to be able to move on, get back to business as usual until there's some justice here in these cases. And so you see folks using lots of tactics that are really visible, showing up in places. In Los Angeles, where a former prosecutor, I heard you on earlier with Ben Crump talking about the power of prosecutors in these, you know, in these cases and in these fights for justice for people who have been victims of these types of violence. In Los Angeles, Black Lives Matter showed up weekly at former prosecutor Jackie Lacey's office, demanding that she prosecute a number of cases, right? Keeping those cases at the forefront.
I think that's, it's an interesting strategic point, right? That on one hand, you could see local organizations, activists mobilized on that kind of drumbeat weekly basis. But I'm also thinking about that national, you know, you've kind of played out for us this local versus national. From a strategic perspective, right, we just know that national media isn't going to stay on any one story, right, in that kind of weekly drumbeat. Are there key moments kind of in that road to justice or at least accountability when national organizations like Color of Change or national media are most useful, like maybe the indictment phase or the sentencing phase? I'm just wondering if there are, if there's strategy around that mobilization.
Yeah, I think we try to create a lot of moments. And this is, you know, part of what I wanted to get to is that, you know, that yes, there are these stages around the case, like you said. There's indictment, grand jury. There are the release of videos, things like that. That's often really a peak moment in attention, right? When there's a visual for people to see, to get clarity on, or to debate, you know, what they're seeing, whether the case is going to be up front. When the case is starting, you know, during the course of the George Floyd case, you know, we had, you know, 24-hour monitoring, basically, of what was happening, trying to keep people informed online. You know, we thought about it almost like the O.J. Simpson case, right? And that we knew that people would be paying close attention to it as an opportunity to not only keep the focus on the case, but on the overall issues that are being brought up. I think there's also other moments like that are celebratory or commemorative, right? So the birthday of the person, the anniversary of their passing, right? These are the moments where we try to push them back into the national conversation for sure. And then we try to create moments, you know? So there may be, say for instance, in the case of Breonna Taylor, local activists and we collaborated with these folks, you know, just taking moments that are normally part of the story of Louisville, like the Kentucky Derby, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. And trying to turn it into a moment that's about Breonna Taylor by showing up at the protest. We flew a plane banner over the Kentucky Derby, right? So also just inserting this story into those other kind of national moments that spotlight these cities and these communities.
When you mentioned the birthday of the person who's been victimized, help us understand the difference between keeping the victim and their story, their reality at the center, without making sort of just the moment of their death the only thing that we know about them.
Right. We believe in a Black joy approach to this work, even though we're dealing with devastating, heartbreaking cases many times. We want to celebrate the person's life. We want to for lack of a better word, humanize them, right? Because so often the opposition, the forces that are anti-accountability, are trying to demonize, criminalize these individuals. So when we get to lift up their birthday, we get to tell the story of their life, right, rather than their death. And I think that's incredibly important to keeping people engaged, keeping people demanding justice, and, you know, reminding us that why we're fighting in the first place, because we want to defend the lives of Black people against racist and state sanctioned violence.
What is your one piece of advice for folks who might be frustrated about the stories that have fallen out of the news, where they're like, but I really want to know what happens next there, and I want to impact and affect it?
Well, I will go back to my original point, you know, that there are, I promise you, there are local activists, the families, there are local journalists, attorneys that are all sticking on these cases. They're being persistent. They're determined to see justice. And I would find them. I think on social media is one of the best tools. Finding those local activists who are focused on those individual cases, they will give you actions you can take, things that you can do, even as the cases fade from the national spotlight.
Scott Roberts is Senior Director of Criminal Justice Campaigns for Color of Change. Thank you for joining us, Scott.
Thank you.
Say her name. Say her name. Say her name. She cannot be forgotten by us. Say her name. Say her name. Say her name. Say her name.
That's composer and soloist Alicia Lee, leading the chorus of the University of Michigan in a piece that captures the agonizing reality of deadly state violence against Black women like Breonna Taylor. State violence against Black women, femme, and queer folk is rarely at the center of mass mobilization and media attention. And that's despite the fact that Black women are overrepresented among the people shot and killed by the police, and the reality that transgender people are more than three times as likely to experience police violence as cisgender people. With me now is Andrea Ritchie, co-founder of Interrupting Criminalization, an initiative that aims to end the criminalization of women and LGBTQ people of color. She's also author of Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Great to have you back on the show, Andrea.
So good to be back in conversation with you, Melissa.
Let's talk for a moment about Breonna Taylor and the ways that there was kind of a twin mobilization around George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, but very little sense that there has been any justice done in the case for Breonna.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, one thing that you and I have been in conversation about these issues for many years, and I think, you know, Breonna Taylor's case brought more visibility than I've seen in 30 years of organizing around Black women's experiences of police violence to our experiences of police violence. But unfortunately, visibility is just the starting point. It can't be the end game. And we haven't made progress towards a world where Breonna would still be with us. And that would be a world where we would need to end the war on drugs that killed her, not just one particular form of raid that isn't even going to be stopped by the laws that have been passed. And so I think the lesson is more and more people are aware that Black women are the group most likely to be killed by police when unarmed of any group, but we haven't yet taken the action needed to stop that from being the case, to stop the killings from happening in the first place. And also to pay attention to the other forms of violence that Black women and girls experience at the hands of police, such as sexual violence that, you know, for instance, the officer who killed Breonna Taylor had engaged in multiple times beforehand. And perhaps if we had paid more attention to that, Breonna would still be with us today. There was a young Black woman, Zoya Code, who was also choked by Derek Chauvin several years before he murdered George Floyd in the context of a call for help. And if we had paid more attention to her case, perhaps we would be in a different position as well. So I think we really need to move beyond visibility to action that's really informed by Black women and girls and trans and queer people's experiences of police violence.
What are some of the reasons that we don't pay attention?
I think the basic reason is that this country and our society is built on violence against Black women, girls, queer and trans people, and it's inherently and intentionally invisibilized as a result. the other piece of it is that Black women, girls, and trans people often experience police violence in the context of calls for help. And that produces discomfort when police legitimize their existence around the fact that they're needed to respond to calls for help. So in other words, if the vast majority of police violence against Black women and girls takes place in the context that police use to legitimize their existence, then that's going to produce an uncomfortable silence, right? Including among the organizations that we would hope would call attention to violence against Black women and girls, because the anti-violence movement has so deeply invested in law enforcement as the response to violence, gender-based violence, sexual violence. And we've seen that in the context of Me Too, so sort of re-upped. And so I think that Black women and girls and trans people's experiences of police violence really put into question our whole society's reliance on cops to stop violence, given that they perpetrate violence in the context of responding to violence.
So I want you to kind of put that down where the goats can get it. So when you say calls for help and the idea that like we're asking police to respond to help around violence and then violence occurs, give me, you don't even have to give names, although you certainly can. Give me an example of what that looks like, how a Black woman or trans person has been harmed by police when they called police to help.
I think the first name that comes to mind is a Tatiana Jefferson killed by police on a welfare check, you know, because a neighbor was concerned for her safety and the police's response was killing her. I think of Kayla Moore, a Black trans woman who was experiencing or was thought to be experiencing a mental health crisis, who was suffocated to death by 8 police officers piled on top of her instead of rendering her the assistance that she needed. I think of Kiwi Herring, a Black trans woman who came into contact with police because of tremendous homophobic and transphobic violence she was experiencing in her home. And the morning she was killed by police, her neighbor had set fire to her porch.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Hi, I'm Helga Davis. On my show, I speak with artists and thinkers about how to uncover the extraordinary in everyday life. People like musicians Brittany Howard and Sampha, Broadway director Whitney White, scholar Noli Way Rooks, and playwright Suzanne Laurie Parks. These are fearless conversations where we don't just meet each other, we meet ourselves. Join us. Listen to Helga wherever you get podcasts.
And she was the one who was killed in the context of the call for help. I think of Aura Rosser, who was killed during a domestic violence call, or Janisha Fonville, who was also killed during a domestic violence call. And those are just the stories of killings. I haven't sort of mentioned stories like Tiawanda Moore is a Black woman who called for help because she was experiencing domestic violence and instead was sexually assaulted by the police officer who responded, or the stories of the women who call the cops or go in to report sexual assault only to be sexually assaulted by the cops they're reporting it to. There are so many cases, this is part of what's invisible about women's experiences of police violence, is it does take place on the streets in public view in the ways that it did for George Floyd, for instance. You know, Frankie Perkins is a Black woman who was choked to death in public on the streets of Chicago in full view on the assumption that she had swallowed drugs. So there's definitely the cases that happen in very similar ways to what we see publicly in terms of Black men's experiences, but many Black women and queer and trans people's experiences of police violence happen in the home, in private places, in the context of calls for help. And so I think the reason that we don't talk about it is because as a society, we have deemed that law enforcement is what we've invested in as the response to domestic violence, as the response to sexual assault, as the response to homophobic and transphobic violence. And so when those responses are sites of violence, then it puts into question our approach to public safety wholesale. And I think that's part of the reason that people don't want to talk about it, because it really requires us to rethink how we approach public safety and whether policing, in fact, is producing it or is producing more violence. You know, that reality is played out in how survivors approach policing. So almost half of survivors of domestic violence and 2/3 of survivors of sexual assault never call police for help. And that's part of the reason, is because they're worried about experiencing harm, criminalization, or not getting the help or protection or prevention they need. And so our current approach is leaving the majority of survivors behind and unprotected. And that's another thing that our experiences of policing surfaces and reveals and puts into question.
Andrea Ritchie is a co-founder of Interrupting Criminalization and author of Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Thanks so much for joining us, Andrea.
Thanks so much for having me, Melissa.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. James Spears, father and now infamous conservator of Britney Spears, filed a petition on Tuesday asking the court to, quote, seriously consider whether this conservatorship is no longer required. Now, this move reflects a meaningful change in Spears' public position about the conservatorship that has controlled nearly every aspect of pop star Britney Spears' life since 2008. The request is being hailed as a victory for the hashtag Free Britney movement, which is an ongoing digital effort by members of the public who support the 39-year-old icon's own efforts to be granted relief from the controlling legal arrangement. Hashtag Free Britney gained renewed energy after a June 2021 hearing when Spears gave personal testimony asking the judge to end her conservatorship.
I truly believe this conservatorship is abusive. And though we can sit here all day and say, oh, conservatorships are here to help people, but ma'am, there's 1,000 conservatorships that are abusive as well. So basically, this conservatorship is doing me way more harm than good. I deserve to have a life. I've worked my whole life. I deserve to have a 2 to 3 year break and just, you know, do what I want to do.
Haley Moss is an attorney and autism advocate who's been following and writing about Britney Spears' conservatorship. Thank you so much for being here, Haley.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So why do you think people have become so invested, and a lot of us are very invested, in what is happening with Britney Spears?
So I think a lot of us are really invested in the Britney Spears conservatorship battle because, at least for my generation, we really grew up with Britney Spears. So I'm in my late 20s, and I remember growing up with Britney Spears' hits since I was probably in about the first grade. So for me, Britney is something that has always been a figure. And I think a lot of us also very much remember when she did have very public struggles with mental health over a decade ago as well. And seeing how this unfolded was really terrifying for a lot of folks. A lot of folks aren't familiar with conservatorship or guardianship, and seeing someone who we once criticized and adored as children and as adults as well somehow be in this position, I think is really jarring for a lot of fans and the general public.
Talk to me a little bit about that adoration and that critique, you know, kind of on the Takeaway team, as we were talking about putting this discussion together. You know, one of the things we were talking about is just the idea that she has been in the public eye for basically her entire life. And so many people have opinions and feelings about her without actually ever having even met her.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of that opinion really goes to how we treat young women and women in society more broadly. So as a young woman, or even as a teenager, Britney Spears had a lot of criticism that she was being scrutinized for her every move and expected to act like a very mature adult. Yet, as she is an adult and she's under conservatorship, she's being treated like a child in that, no, you can't do this, or no, you can't do that. So for me, that's been really interesting to see, is how that narrative has really played out. And I think people are far more critical of themselves as well and how they've treated Britney over the years, whether it's the media or whether it's how fans reacted, or even seeing how the discourse even circled back to that viral moment from when Britney first had mental health struggles with Chris Crocker saying to leave Britney alone, seeing how things circled back even that way. I think it's really been fascinating, but yeah, there's really a lot to unpack there too.
Talk a bit about how the issue of the conservatorship is also a disability rights issue.
So guardianships and conservatorships primarily do impact people with disabilities above all else. So to be placed under a guardianship or conservatorship, it's something that a third party needs to initiate with the courts. So the people who do get placed under these arrangements are usually people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. So people like me who are autistic, or people with intellectual disabilities, or also people with psychiatric and mental health disabilities, or older folks who might have some form of cognitive decline like Alzheimer's or dementia. And the point of these guardianships and conservatorships is ultimately to protect people, but it's seen, or at least it's supposed to be used, as a last resort. So there's plenty of different alternatives to allow someone to have control in their life, but also get the support they need to make major decisions. But with guardianship and conservatorship, they're used, as Brittany was saying in her testimony, abusively at times, or that the person with a disability has very little power over the decisions that they make in their everyday life. So even when Brittany was testifying how she can't see her boyfriend whenever she wants, or even that she hasn't had a say in her own reproductive health care, those are the kinds of things that could happen in a conservatorship. We don't really know what happens in a lot of conservatorships because we don't hear public testimony like we did with Brittany. A lot of these cases are kept highly confidential and they aren't as regulated.
So, all right, zoom in on this a bit for us and try to, because part of what I hear in the public conversation is, oh, well, if she has control over her own life, she's going to make mistakes. There's going to be bad things that happen. And so how do we think through, in responsible ways, the right to autonomy and decision making versus this kind of paternal desire to protect?
Here's the thing that I see. Every single one of us makes mistakes. We've all made bad decisions, whether we were teenagers, young adults, or older adults. It's just that when you're a person with a disability, or you're also a person like Brittany, who is seemingly disabled and also a very public figure, those poor decisions or bad decisions are scrutinized that much more heavily. I think a lot about the examples of people with intellectual disabilities who might, for instance, throw an object across the room, and immediately it's noted that they were just behaving poorly, or they were having an outburst, or something that gets noted in a chart. While if, for instance, one of us throws something, we might just chalk it off to that we had a bad day. So Brittany's going to be under far more scrutiny for the decisions that she makes. I do think with her having control and that self-autonomy, Brittany should have a really great team of people who advise her, who support her, and help her. But at the end of the day, she's the ultimate decision maker. And a lot of that kind of does go to what a lot of guardianship reform advocates have been saying as well, is that for alternatives to having conservatorships and guardianships, is that we do put the person in the driver's seat, but they have the support of people that they trust and they get advice from them. But at the end of the day, they're the ones who make the decision.
Haley Moss, thank you so much. Again, the point that she is a grown adult, right? We've known her since she's a child, but she's not a child anymore. Haley Moss is an attorney. She's also an autism activist and a little bit of a Britney fan herself. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
This Saturday marks 20 years since the September 11th terrorist attacks. In the immediate aftermath of the attacks, there were serious questions about the why and the who. But over the years, we've asked fewer questions and settled on a widely shared narrative about that day and how it happened. Re-examining collective complacency that emerged over two decades is part of the focus of the podcast Blindspot, The Road to 9/11. It's a co-production of the History Channel and WNYC Studios. The podcast chronicles the events that led up to the 9/11 attacks with a reporter who was on the ground when it happened.
I was living in Staten Island, and when I heard about the first plane, I rushed to a hill with a clear view of the World Trade Center. The second plane suddenly flew over me, coming in loud and low. And when it hit, I saw the fireball and the smoke.
Jim O'Grady is a reporter at WNYC and host of Blindspot, The Road to 9/11. Jim, it's great to have you here.
Same here, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So talk about why a podcast like this is necessary 20 years later.
Well, we know what happened after 9/11. We know about the wars. We know about the bulking up of Homeland Security in the United States. But what is less well known, and this came as a surprise even to me, is the 11 years leading up to 9/11. I reported on 9/11 like a lot of other people, and I thought I knew the story. But the way an ideology crossed the ocean after the war between Afghanistan rebels and the Soviet Union, and then metastasized, and then led to this chain of events that ultimately gave us 9/11. A lot of it happening on the streets of New York. I was not as familiar with that story. So that's the story we sought out to tell from two points of view, from investigators trying to puzzle out this novel threat that was emerging, and from jihadists who saw the United States as an imperium that interfered in Muslim politics and needed to be attacked in some way.
There are historians who will maintain that we can't really have a clear view on history as long as that history is living, right? That is, as long as there is a substantial portion of the population with the living memory, that we don't have clear vision and view. But you are really working in this podcast to help us to collectively re-engage our memories.
Well, isn't that what the 20th anniversary is for? It's kind of an artificial marker, but 20 years is a decent amount of time. And we still have the eyewitnesses that we could interview, as we did for the podcast, players in the CIA, the FBI, the White House, the Pentagon, childhood friends of Osama bin Laden, leading Arab journalists who knew that world and know that world. That's who we talked to do this first draft of history with some of the key primary sources. So it's worth doing. Future historians will no doubt have more perspective, but we have a vivid story of the development of this clash of really, I mean, it's been called a clash of civilizations, but this conflict that led to nearly 3,000 lives being lost on the day of 9/11.
So without giving it all away, Jim, walk us through some of those critical moments that led to September 11th.
We can now see the chain of events over the 11 years leading up to 9/11 and how they connect. And we start our story with an assassination in 1990 in a Midtown hotel. An assassin called Saeed Nosseir, a Muslim extremist, guns down Rabbi Meir Kahana, a Zionist extremist. And we can now see that Saeed Nosseir was part of a terror cell based in a mosque in Brooklyn, whose members of the cell then went on to pull off the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, where six people died. The mastermind of that bombing, Ramzi Youssef, got away with a plan in his head for flying planes into buildings. He got caught, but that plan was passed on to his uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who eventually connected with Osama bin Laden, and the plot moves forward and the tragedy occurs. We can see that chain now, and it has so many twists and so many surprises and so many moments when American law enforcement almost stopped it. And there's debates to this day about what should and shouldn't have been done. And that's the story we tell in the podcast.
One of the episodes focuses on an Egyptian security expert who's undercover for the FBI. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there and his ongoing role?
This is one of the major surprises for me, this amazing, compelling man named Iman Salem. He's an immigrant from Egypt to America in the early 1990s. He's just a security guy at a hotel. When the FBI approaches him and says, look, there's a guy in New Jersey City named the blind sheikh, an extremist who was involved in the Sadat assassination, the president of Egypt, Anwar al-Sadat. And we think he might be coalescing a terror cell. And we want you to risk your life to go undercover and tell us what's going on. And that's what Emad Salem did, out of patriotism for his new country. And he was honest with us, a sense of revenge about the blind sheikh killing who he called his president, Anwar al-Sadat, when Salem was in the Egyptian military. And what Salem uncovered was amazing. Unfortunately, his supervisor, the FBI, pulled him out of his undercover operation at exactly the wrong time, when he was about to discover the 1993 World Trade Center bombing plot. And that was just a catastrophic mistake. But he went back in, and then he later prevented an even deadlier plot that was well on the way to unfolding. Emad Salem, an amazing character. He's sort of the star of the first four episodes of the podcast.
You know, you've reminded us a couple times now of the 1993 attack on the World Trade Center. And, you know, I have a daughter who is almost 20. And, you know, just for her, those centers are just maybe something, you know, in the intro to an old television show or something. They don't have quite that same power. But let's listen to a clip for just a moment from Professor Haeckel, a professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University, about the towers.
There was no greater symbol of America's material prowess and dominance than those buildings. The World Trade Center in particular became an obsession for radical Islamists who believed that they could bring down the United States, just as they had done the Soviets in Afghanistan.
So say a bit more about that symbol of those towers.
They soared. They were muscular. They were on Manhattan Island, the beating heart of global capitalism. And Professor Haeckel also made the point that because these jihadists had tried to take them down in 1993 with a truck bomb in the basement and failed, they became even more of an obsession to go back and try again, as occurred on 9/11. So they really had this sort of magnetic presence in New York and in America, and it certainly provoked the animus, the murderous animus of people like Osama bin Laden, who wanted to deal not just symbolic, but economic blows against the United States.
I was thinking of this morning, that there's a way that as we're marking this moment, and as we have over 20 years, often the Pentagon is spoken about less often, the attack there. And I'm wondering if you think that is in part simply about the architecture of it, the particular ways that the tower and the horror, particularly of watching the second plane hit the South Tower, if the architecture is part of why that is the moment that most stands out.
Ironically, the architect of the Twin Towers was inspired by Islamic architecture, by buildings in Saudi Arabia, which was why at the base of the Twin Towers, you saw these pointed arches, which is a common feature of Islamic architecture. Another expert we talked to speculated that it would not have been hard for Osama bin Laden to see the sacred architecture of Islam being bent toward commercialism, toward capitalism, in the very architecture of the Twin Towers, which could have also driven his decision to take them down. And if I could just make this point really quickly, we talked to a childhood friend of Osama bin Laden who said he was not just rich, he was Rockefeller rich growing up. His father was the richest man in the Persian Gulf. So just as it took David Rockefeller to have the hubris to clear a neighborhood and put those towers up, it took the mirror image hubris of Osama bin Laden. When you're that rich, you automatically have power and the assumption that you get to decide how the world is made and what lives and what dies, in effect. And so it took a Rockefeller-rich megalomaniac like bin Laden to conceive of taking them down, which is, when you think about it, is an extraordinary thing. I can take those things down and I can kill all of the people in there, or at least try.
Jim O'Grady is a reporter at WNYC and host of the podcast Blind Spot, The Road to 9/11. Jim, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much, Melissa. Go Takeaway.
You can listen to the full 9-episode series at blindspotpodcast.org. And that's the show, people. Now, on another issue of women, girls, media representation, and power, I want to let you know about a fantastic event we have for you tomorrow. The Takeaway Live will be coming to you on Facebook Live. Now, this is part of our show marking 20 years since the September 11th terrorist attacks. At 12 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday, you can head on over to the Takeaways Facebook page. There you can watch me in conversation with activist and founder of MuslimGirl.com, Amani Akutaba. And we'll also be talking with journalist and author Mona El-Tahawi. We're going to be talking about the experiences of Muslim women in the U.S. over the past two decades. So go to Facebook.com/The Takeaway to check it out. That's tomorrow, noon Eastern. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.